David Epstein has joined us on Sports Byline USA. I hope you'll check out the book. It's fascinating to think about the things that he's looked into. The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. David, just the talking about this subject would seem to be a little bit on the dry side, but I hear enthusiasm in your voice. It sounds like you've answered some questions that a lot of us have had about sports, what makes the great athletes the truly great ones.
I mean, these were, for me, the deepest questions I had about sports and reporting this book. You know, I didn't know most of this stuff before I started learning about it and traveling the world to learn it, and it's really changed the way I watch sports. So I hope it doesn't come across as dry. Now, all the science I made sure to wrap in the tales of actual athletes so that it's accessible.
Let me share with you a comment made by Michael Jordan. I don't think anybody would disagree, one of the greatest, if not greatest, basketball players ever. And he once said to me, and I wonder how this factors in, and I think it applies when I asked him about the truly great athletes. What's the definition of a truly great athlete, no matter what the sport might be? And I've heard this from Billie Jean King in tennis. I've heard it from Reggie Jackson in baseball and others like that. But Michael said it best. He said, when the game is on the line, I want to be the one to determine the outcome. If I succeed, I want the glory. If I fail, I'll take the blame. And I think you know as well as I do, David, that not everybody is comfortable with failing or comfortable with getting criticized for that failure.
No, I mean, that's a very, very special thing. I mean, when you think about, you know, and I think about things that make me nervous in normal life and then amplify it to that degree where, you know, how many people are watching you, and that's an unbelievable trait that I think is a, you know, it takes a lot of mental fortitude to want that. And I think that's an amazing thing and a special sort of skill that's partly, I think, innate personality, but also certainly developed that you see really in the greatest of the great athletes.
Is there any reason why certain athletes feel that way, that aren't afraid to fail?
Well, I think a lot of that, I think, you know, so I write a little bit in the book about a gene called the warrior gene, that one version of it makes people more prone to anxiety in kind of pressure circumstances, and another version, it alters a brain chemical. Another version makes them very sort of stoic in the face of pressure. So I think there is a biological component to it, surprisingly, or it surprised me. At the same time, I think it has a lot to do with faith in your own training and the support system around you and coaches and teammates making you feel like, you know, not afraid of failure so that you can really go out and give it your best.
You, in this book, you investigate the so-called 10,000-hour rule. Tell me about that.
So the 10,000-hour rule has become sort of shorthand for the idea that anyone who practices 10,000 hours will become elite in whatever they do, surgery, music, sports, whatever. But the rule actually comes from a study of 10 violinists who are already highly pre-screened. So most of humanity was totally screened out. So it really couldn't make any conclusion about what every man on the street can do. And it turns out that really it's just an average of individual differences. So in the second chapter, I write about two high jumpers, for example. One who had about 20,000 hours of effortful practice, and another who started high jumping on a bet at lunch and basically realized he was really good. And the guy who had about 0 hours beats the guy with 20,000 hours at the 2007 World Championships. So there you have a guy with almost zero hours, and a guy with 20,000. So the average is 10,000. But the average tells you nothing. What you want to know is the range. And in every study that's ever been done, there's a huge range of hours that it takes to get to expertise. And that's indicative of human biological differences.
The other thing I think is interesting is how has drugs and also you know, food and the way they train, but in this day and age where we have performance-enhancing drugs, how has that affected performance?
It's affected. So one, I remember when I was looking at how body types have changed in different sports, and you can see, for example, in linemen in the NFL, a steady progression of guys getting bigger, and then sort of in the 70s and 80s when steroids really proliferated in the NFL, you see this huge acceleration of the size of the players. So I think it really has push some sports to almost being like comically, you know, these like superheroes playing it, these guys that are so big. And it's completely changed the picture of an aging athlete. So I talked to some baseball executives about this. You know, when Josh Hamilton, for example, got signed for over $100 million, even though he was clearly past the age when players peak, but some of the baseball executives told me that, you know, the Sammy Sosas, the Barry Bonds, the Mark McGuires have set up this completely unrealistic picture of what an aging athlete looks like, and that's why you're still seeing some of these nine-figure contracts taking guys until they're 40 years old.
Yeah, that was where I was going next about the money in the game. Does that affect performance?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the money incentives, I have a chapter called The Big Bang of Body Types, and it's basically about how when bigger money came into sports, the global search for these unique body types that would succeed more in sports became much wider, and we started to see this extreme specialization of body types. The tall athletes got taller, and the short athletes got shorter. So like in women's gymnastics, the average elite female gymnast has shrunk from 5'3 to 4'9 in the last 30 years as these body types keep getting more specialized.
And there's another factor too, David, and that is the injury factor. We're hearing an awful lot about concussions, most certainly in the National Football League. But given the conflict between, you know, athletes in certain sports like football, even basketball, and hockey as well, I would think that that would have something to do with the capabilities of athletes and how they react to being injured.
Absolutely. And I think I'm, for the most part, and I say this in the book, wouldn't recommend most genetic testing for athleticism, but the kind I would recommend that are now available are one for a gene called APOE4 that predisposes people to having brain damage if they get concussions. So there, that's something you might want to know about. About 20 to 25% of people have that version of the gene. And if they get hit in the head, they just don't recover that well, and they're more likely to suffer permanent damage. And that might be information we don't want to hide from, although few people sort of know about that test, frustratingly. And there are also genes that code for collagen, which is like your body's glue, that in tendons and ligaments, some versions of which make people more prone to tear an ACL. And that's maybe a scary thing to know, but you can do strengthening exercises that will make you less likely to tear that ACL. So I think there's actually some information we can use from genetic testing right now.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, should we test the genes of, say, like young children to determine if they're capable of being stars?
No, I don't think so. And for the most part, stardom is such a complex phenomenon. So you know, that involves coaching and support and positive reinforcement and biology. So for one of the tests that's commonly marketed now is for the ACTN3 gene. It makes a protein that's in fast-twitch muscle fibers. And basically, if you don't have one of the so-called right versions, you know, your kid's not going to be in the 100-meter finals in Rio in 2016. But you can take your kid to the park and have him race the other kids and figure that out a lot more accurately. So I don't think, aside from the sort of injury and brain damage genes and ones that predispose young athletes to sudden death on the field, I don't think there's a lot of use in testing for most of the performance genes just yet.
After you've done your research and you have this book out called The Sports Gene, I want to take you back to 2003 and Alex Rodriguez, because you did investigative pieces, including the revelation that A-Rod tested positive for steroids in 2003. And I think what blows most fans' mind is here is a guy that has signed a multi-million dollar contract, averaging about $27 million a season, has talent, has a lot of talent, but yet they'll do something that'll put it all in jeopardy. Most people can't understand that. Maybe you can help me out and help them out.
Well, two things. First of all, I think I don't think there's been any definitive proof that he wasn't, that talent didn't come from doping in a big way in the first place. We know he's admitted to doping as early as 2001, but that's because my colleague and I basically proved that, and then he admitted it. So we don't know how long he's been doping. But when I sort of started backgrounding Alex, I really realized that he had kind of a lot of the psychological characteristics of gym goers who I came to know who were using steroids and other drugs, which was that he was very vain. He was sort of concerned not only about how he performed but how he looked. And I think a guy, he signs a contract that takes him into his 40s. It doesn't really surprise me that he would get involved in something like this to try to basically be young again, and I think he had a long-time reliance on these kinds of drugs, and I'm not sure he knows how to perform without them.
Yeah, can it become addictive? And I suppose this is more of a personality flaw than anything else, that you get used to success, and then you can't accept anything less than it, and if the performance-enhancing drugs are the things that give you that success, then that's what you accept the rest of your career.
Yeah, psychologically addictive, I think, not physically addictive, and I've been around him, and you see how people act around a guy like that, who has a lot of money and who has a lot of fame, there are a lot of sycophants surrounding him, and so I think he lives in this sort of unreal world, and sometimes they feel like they can do no wrong, and the worst thing for I think a person who is vain and who has is surrounded by a bunch of yes men is ever to not be in that situation. So I think they'll often do anything to keep it going.
One of the questions I saw in the material I was looking at in preparing for you to coming on is, are there genetic reasons to separate male and female athletes in competition? And I had never thought about that since women have much more of an opportunity now. But how do you look upon that?
There are. So the problem is, so one gene on the Y chromosome, called the sex-determining region Y gene, is the one that causes in utero the cells to form that then produce testosterone. And testosterone causes a huge range of changes in the male body, denser bones that can support more muscle mass, more muscle fibers per area, even an increase in red blood cells that make for better endurance. I mean, the difference in upper body strength between male and female, men and women, is about the same as male and female gorillas. So it's huge. The strange thing is, though, that we separate sports into male and female, but human biology doesn't always separate that easily. So like with the case of the South African runner Caster Semenya, who got embroiled in this biological sex controversy, for most of us, our chromosomes and our genes and our psychology and our body match either male or female. But there are some competitors who have kind of a mixed match of those characteristics, and they are very difficult sometimes for sporting bodies to classify because human biology just doesn't always break down into strictly male and female as I think politely as sports organizers wish it would.
Is there anything that surprised you that came out of this research and writing this book?
I'd say the biggest surprise for me was the chapter where I write about genes involved in motivation, basically. So that's about genes in the dopamine system, which is involved in the sense of pleasure and reward. And I knew that brain system is affected when people exercise, that biology responds to exercise. I didn't know that it was well known among scientists that study this that training and exercise actually respond to that biology, that some people have dopamine systems set up in such a way that they only feel comfortable if they're working out a lot and they're moving a lot. You can medicate those people with, for example, ADHD drugs, and they'll feel less like they have to move. So you can play with their dopamine system and make them feel less compulsive drive to train. That was a surprise to me. I guess we all know that some of our friends are lazier than others, but I didn't realize there was so much science behind that.
What can we take away from this book, when people read it? What do you want them to understand better than what they did before they read the book?
Well, I think that the new definition of talent that exercise genetics is giving us is how your body is set up to interact with a certain kind of training so that you may get more or less benefit from a certain training plan than your training partner. And the reason I think that's important to know is, we shouldn't just keep banging our head against the wall if a training plan isn't working. Your genome is completely unique in the world. And so for the best results, you should technically have a completely unique training plan. So I think we should all be taking a trial and error approach to our own exercise and training. And if we're not really trying to find the environment that's the best for our totally unique genome.
We only have a minute left, but sports trickles down, and the kids try to replicate what they see in the professional athlete. And I'm just wondering, is that a dangerous thing to do since we're all individuals?
I think it is. I think there are certain practices that can be replicated for sure. And I think it's good when young athletes get motivation from pro athletes. What I think the danger is taking a cookie-cutter approach and assuming that what worked for someone else will necessarily work for you. That's I think, where the danger is. So I think you have to keep an eye toward, the best coaches sort of know this. They individualize training plans intuitively, and that would be the best for everyone if we could do it that instead of just copying what you see.
What do you want people to take away from the book then?
I want them to take away that we're all completely unique, and so that if we want to be the best athletes we can be, then we really have to try to figure out our own biology and what training sort of fits with it.
And are you happy with the way the book turned out?
I'm very happy with the way it turned out, yeah, and I've gotten a great response to it so far. So it changed the way that I watch sports. So it was a book that I wanted to read, so that's why I decided to write it.
Well, a fascinating subject, and that's why I wanted to have you on, and I hope that people who, as they listen to you across the country and around the world, will take heart about some of the things that you say and kind of accept your enjoyment of sports on many different levels, because we're all not going to be superstars, that's for sure.
That's true, but sports for me is a beautiful display of human biological diversity, and I hope that comes through in the book.
David, thank you very much. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks very much for having me. My pleasure.
David Epstein with us again. Check it out, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. We continue with more of you in Sports Byline.